King's Cross Station, London, August 1906. The man stood near the corner of the booking offices as I emerged from the ladies' waiting room, pretending to read a newspaper. He was dressed in a kind of comfortable suit of brown Harris tweed, with which any fellow might clothe himself for a long train journey. Except he wore it awkwardly, stiff and overly buttoned, like a schoolboy given his first grown-up jacket and trousers. His face I recognized. It was plain and wide. The pale skin hung upon a pair of broad cheekbones, and the hair underneath the tweed cap was a raucous ginger. A man I could never forget. I had first seen him in March, 5 months ago, upon the Greek island of Naxos. For an instant, we met eyes. I say an instant, but it felt like a minute or more. So charged was the connection between us, and so deep the shock to my bones. He made no sign of recognition, except for having taken the trouble to transfix me at all, and once he accomplished this act, he folded the newspaper twice, tucked it under his arm, and walked off in the direction of the departure platform, where he disappeared into the thickening crowd. According to the station clock, it was now 9:48, and the Scottish Express left King's Cross Station promptly at 10. The air was grossly hot and smelled of coal smoke and human perspiration. At the end of the platform, an enormous green locomotive rumbled and boiled, working up a head of steam. The space between us was a carnival of passengers, porters, carts, conductors, and luggage, and somewhere inside it all lurked the man with the ginger hair. My palm was damp inside its cotton glove. I renewed my grip on the handle of my valise. I have always carried my own luggage whenever possible, and turned to the right, marching toward the first-class Pullman coach exactly midway down the platform. The conductor frowned slightly at my serviceable jacket and hat, at the valise in my hand. I held out my ticket. His face transformed. "Good morning, Miss True Love," he said. "And might I trouble you to follow me?" Thus we boarded the train. I cast a final glance down the platform as I mounted the steps, but saw no flash of ginger beneath a brown tweed cap. It was not until I settled in my seat, in a private compartment reserved entirely for my use by my employer, the Duke of Olympia, that I caught sight of him again, walking slowly toward the locomotive, hands shoved in his pockets. I craned my neck until he passed out of view, and then I rushed from the compartment to stick my head from the door of the coach, balancing dangerously from the iron steps while shreds of steam drifted around me. Nearly all the passengers had boarded. The last tearful farewells were taking place, the swift embraces between lovers. For a second or two, a series of baggage carts obscured the man's back until he emerged alone, the fringe of hair just visible at his collar, and swung suddenly to the left into a third-class carriage on the other side of the dining car. The whistle screamed. The shouts of the conductors ran down the platform. I pulled myself back inside the coach, while the beat of my heart echoed above them all, spinning my blood, and somebody's hand came to rest on the sleeve of my jacket. "Is something the matter, Miss True Love?" asked the conductor. He was about 50 years old, and his face briefly resembled that of my dead father, kind and serious, bracketed by a handsome pair of mutton chops. I stared at him until the shrill whistle cried again, and the vision went away. The whiskers dissolved. The man's face reassembled into its plain, haggardly London self. "Thank you for your concern," I said, "but I am quite all right.